This week on the In-Depth Podcast, Jerry Seinfeld. I've been trying to get Jerry on the show for years and was thrilled when we finally got him. While I read hundreds of pages worth of articles on Jerry and watched hours and hours of interviews, one thing I did not know is he likes to show up very early for these things, which created some funny moments before the interview.
How do you feel now if you're at Graham Van Cigar? Keeping me waiting.
So that was Jerry sitting down for the interview more than 20 minutes early, and I'm still in a different room getting ready. So our producer, Brett, sprints up the stairs to the top story of this brownstone on the Upper West Side that we had rented to do this filming. Upon learning Jerry was already in the chair, obviously I immediately go down and we get going. We covered a wide range of topics, which of course included his sitcom and the secret to its success.
We killed ourselves, physically killed ourselves.
And the struggle with what to do next.
So now what? What do I do in life now?
The father of three also opens up about family life.
You don't have kids.
I don't.
Someone that doesn't have kids would ask that question.
What his own father taught him.
He had every possible tool you could have. And I learned it all from him.
And the make or break moments early in his comedy career.
That was abject terror.
Plus, he reveals the phone calls that led to an all-star cast in his movie, Unfrosted.
And he called you and
said, I would like to be Tony the Tiger.
And you said,
you're Tony the Tiger.
But we begin our chat with Jerry's comedic roots.
I wanted to take you back to kind of your earliest comedic days, if that's okay.
So, I love those days.
How about the most memorable of those and why?
Well, there was a lot of drawing of cartoons. I had another friend who we would draw cartoons and we would, compare them and critique them. I would love to have been a cartoonist. It's similar to stand-up. It's a very pure kind of exaggerated reflection of life, cartooning. But I did do a ventriloquist act in my third grade talent show, and I still have the dummy in my office. You know how your mother throws everything out?
Sure.
Somehow this thing didn't get thrown out, and I still have it.
So you would rate comedians on The Tonight Show, I think, back in the day when you were a kid?
I was very judgmental of comedians from the very beginning. I would, even as a little kid, I would go, this guy's not funny, or this guy's really funny. It was funny because my daughter, who was also very talented, and she's a writer and writes comedy, and she started inhaling content at a certain point in her life, and I watched her do it, and it was the same way I did it. I mean, five or six hours of television a day was an absolute minimum for me.
And you said that's how you kind of most learned about life.
That's how you learned about how I learned about life, but that's how I really learned about all of the various structures that make comedy work. Now, I didn't know, it's funny when you look back on your life, I didn't know that's what I was doing.
Right.
But I look back on it and I go, that's what I was doing. I wanted to know, what is the structure of that joke? Why is that joke funny?
And you would write down jokes.
I would write down all the jokes that I liked.
And then you'd analyze
it. On TV. And I would take, laughing was a really big deal in school in the 60s when that came on, because it was all jokes. So the kids loved it. And the next day we would talk about the show. And I never wanted to forget one of the good jokes, so I would write them down.
September of 76. What was it about standing on that Long Island Railroad platform in Massapequa that really hit you?
I mean, to this day, it was like, I'm there. You know, I often call comedy an aquarium. It's an aquarium, and you're a tropical fish. And if you can get in there, you go, well, this is it. This is the environment, I can live in this environment for the rest of my life and avoid all the things of life I don't want to do and do the one thing I do want to do.
But it wasn't as if you'd made it big then.
I was making, I think, $60 a week emceeing, which I thought, I'm going to live on $60 a week. That's all I need. But
it was just the idea that now you could make this your profession.
You have to understand, I wasn't one of those people who believed I had talent. I didn't think I had talent. There was one kid at Queens College. We would go watch comedians at the clubs, Catch a Rising Star and the Improv. And one kid had said to me, I bet you could do that. And it was all I ever wanted, but I wouldn't even say it out loud to anyone. But when he said that to me, that was like giving me permission to say, I would like to do that.
Set the scene and tell about the conversation you had with Jackie a few weeks into...
Mason.
Yeah.
Well, so I'm doing comedy like 2 weeks. And I'm at this club called the Golden Lion Pub on West 44th Street, which is really just a restaurant and a bar. And Tuesdays and Thursday nights, they would take out one table and aim one of the lights in the ceiling at the corner. And Broadway singers would sing a couple songs and they would let comedians go on. And it was a couple hour show. You could do 15 minutes. And so I was just starting. I didn't even have a shirt, like this type of, I didn't even have one. I would just go on in a t-shirt and jeans. I was 20 years old. And Jackie Mason was in the audience, who was, you know, a gigantic star in comedy, even then. And he says, come here, I want to talk to you. And he takes me over to the bar, and he says, you're going to be so successful at this, it makes me sick. That was exactly what he said. And I was like, you know. And that carried me probably for 5 years.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Because he was a professional comedian.
Right.
I was just, you know, I was not someone, I thought I was funny, but I thought everybody was funny. All of my friends were funny as I was, I thought.
Describe one of your first shows at Catch a Rising Star where you just go blank.
Well, my first time I went on stage, I went blank. You can't imagine what it feels like to step on a stage as a comedian the very first time, and you don't know if you're funny or not. And when you watch other comedians, it seems like there's a funny atmosphere in the room. The audience seems to be in the mood to laugh when you watch a comedian. Right there, they clap as soon as the person walks out, and they seem almost giddy. And when you walk on stage, that is not what's going on. There's nothing going on. It's just dead quiet. It's a library. And you learn over the years to create, you have to create that mood for them. But when you don't know that, and you walk on stage the first time, and it's just dead silence, and the only sound in the room is your voice, your shaky voice, and these ideas that you don't have any confidence in. And I got up there, and it just hits you like a train. It's just, oh, this is
my hands are sweating, thinking, yeah.
This is way harder than I thought. I thought, they're in the mood to laugh. I'll say some things that are kind of funny, and it'll be okay. And it's not okay. It is not okay. It's just dead silent. And I only was on stage for 2-3 minutes. My mind went completely blank. And then I didn't go on for, I think, 6 months after that.
Why so long?
Because I thought I need to write and prepare something that I really know what I'm doing when I get up there. I realized from that, oh, this is way harder than I thought. I thought I'd be on The Tonight Show in a few weeks. That's how dumb I was.
I mean, you obviously ended up going on Carson a ton. But what about the fear of going on Carson do you miss today?
That was abject terror. Standing behind that curtain of The Tonight Show in 1981 on May 6th, knowing that if I go out there and do 5 minutes and it works, I have a career. And if I don't, I'm going back to the clubs for I don't know how many years, which is okay, but you know, you want to really be this thing. You want to be a professional comedian. You ever see those skiers in the Olympics when they're standing there at the top of the mountain and they got that stick in front of their knees? And you wonder, what does that feel like? You know, I know what that feels like. That the next 90 seconds of my life is gonna change my life. I don't need a lot of that. I've had that a few times.
Your mom was an orphan, your dad left home.
He was an orphan also.
What did each of them tell you about their situations growing up?
They didn't talk much about it, but there was a toughness. Both growing up in orphanages, or in my father's case, really just running from apartment to apartment.
And why?
Because they had no money. So it was a bunch of kids. It was a home where they were not able to live for some bad reasons. And so they decided to set off on their own as a group of brothers and sisters. So it was a lot of street hustling, of selling whatever you could get on the street. And usually they could not make the rent. And after 3 months, they would just bolt and get another place. And so there was that toughness. I was lucky to be around that. Usually, if the parents have a tough life, the kid's life is too easy, and they screw up, and then their kids get tough, hopefully. You know, it tends to be an up-and-down cycle of even in culture, you know. We're in the soft period now.
Well, and so it wasn't like that for you. So you've spoken about how correct me if I'm wrong, like never hugged you, never told you he loved you, never threw a ball with you.
No, but there was a lot of love in my house.
Well, and you said like you and your sister and your parents were almost like roommates in a way. And you called it complete neglect, but in like the best way possible.
Benign neglect is how I was raised. But my parents were very loving, but parents in the 50s and 60s did not express it outwardly like parents do today. There was no emotional hole in my life that people love to say, comedians, that's why they do this. They're filling some emotional need. I have always rejected that very strongly.
What was the hardest part of that kind of self-reliance?
There's nothing hard about it. I mean, I knew I wanted to live a difficult life. I craved a difficult circumstance.
Why?
I don't know. But I think you just know it sometimes when you're a kid. I don't want to do anything easy. And that's why when I found stand-up and I became that thing, I was so gratified and comfortable. You know how much difficulty is the right amount for you. Too much is not good. Not enough is not good. There's a range that we all seek as humans.
But you'll push it.
I'll push
hard.
It.
Yeah.
I will push it.
I think your mom was a bookkeeper for a time, primarily mm-hmm. a housewife. Your dad was in World War II mm-hmm. in the Pacific. He was supportive of your ambition.
Yes.
And he passed when I think you were 30.
Right.
Somebody said to you after his passing that now your career is really going to take off.
Mm-hmm.
Explain that train of thought.
I think sometimes you don't want to surpass your father. You feel bad. You feel bad about it. You feel uncomfortable.
Subconsciously, you think the case for you too?
I don't know. Maybe. I don't know.
He had this box of jokes, mm-hmm. and you wrote in sign language, "There's never been a professional comedian with better stage presence, mm-hmm. attitude, timing or delivery. Elaborate on that if you don't mind.
I mean, he had it all. Talk about, you know, someone who was talented. He never had any opportunities or venue.
He
was a salesman, but he told me he had thought about it, but didn't know, you know, there was no, now there's so many entry points to be a comedian. You go to a club, there's audition night. You know, in 1930, I don't know how people did it. I guess they worked their way in vaudeville somehow, but he never had that opportunity. But he had every possible tool you could have. And I learned it all from him. I got the whole thing from him.
How so?
Well, a lot of it's genetic. Yes.
Oh, come on.
Graham, you can't deny that there's a genetic component to this.
A genetic comedic gene?
Sure. How do you make these calculations? It's in your brain that there's a processor to calculate what these lines, these words, you know.
I mean, maybe
the
you had
calculations
a good
mentor. Of comedy are minute and precise. And you either get it right and there's a big laugh, or you miss a word and there's dead silence. And the difference between those two sounds is a lot of money.
You said your mind works faster under pressure. In what ways is that evident to you?
Things are happen on stage that do not happen anyplace else in life. You don't even feel your feet when you're on stage. You don't feel your body. You know, you're kind of in hyperspace. The brain is sped up because you're in a fight or flight condition. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a very moment-to-moment survival environment, which is what makes it so addictive. You know, it's very adrenaline fueled. I mean, it's like emergency room stuff, you know? It's like SEAL Team 6, you know? Many, many years of doing comedy, I was talking to a comedian friend of mine the other day. We're talking about how comedians handled the pandemic so easily. It was no problem because our entire life is being thrown into situations and going, figure it out, right now. And so even though the pandemic was 2 years long, curveballs is like, that's your whole life is a curveball.
I think it's 1993, Adam Sandler's opening for you in Boston. You start a bit and somebody yells from the crowd, and how does it affect you?
I had this amazing bit about weddings. It was like, it was fantastic. It was so long, it covered everything. It was a great bit, and I worked on it, and I love developing and polishing every little detail of a bit, so it takes me forever.
Sometimes years.
Years. I was talking to Chris Rock yesterday, and he was telling me about his last special. He said, I had 3 jokes in there that I've worked on for over 10 years. And people don't understand that about comedy. What could take 10 years, you know, but it can if you're obsessive and perfectionist. I start into the bit and somebody yells, heard it, you know, and that was a tough one. I still think about it.
Really?
Yeah, it was like, it was mean, it was true, but you know, I think now audiences are a little more sophisticated that, yeah, these are pieces that we work on for months and months and months. You don't do it once and it works. You know, every scene you see in a movie, they did that 18 times. That was the one time it was good. That's what's in the movie. You don't see the other 17. But same with comedy. I've done this bit 100 times and now I've got it right.
But in fairness to you, even if you're performing a couple shows in the same night at the Beacon Theater, 40% of the material could be different show to show.
Most of it's the same, yeah.
What did the George Burns book teach you?
Love this business, love it. Appreciate, enjoy it. It's the greatest thing in the world. Be happy. Be happy that you're doing this. And that's something you should know, or that would be automatic, that would be natural. But it's not, because you get stressed over the anxiety and where am I at, and this person's doing better than me, and all the the frailties and foibles of being human.
What about on the writing front, though?
Well, he had this routine where he would write 2 hours every day with writers, and they would work on material for his act or whatever he had coming up. And I thought, oh, so you have a regular routine of creating material. This piece of information, this discipline or this understanding, I was doing it, I would say, maybe 8 months, maybe a year, when I realized, oh, this is all about writing. This whole racket is writing. And if you don't become a real writer, creating new material every single day, you're gonna get wasted like that. I saw it happen to a guy who was on The Tonight Show, and he was a smash hit, his first show. Then he came back to do a second one. It's 6 minutes an appearance in those days. To do 6 great minutes on The Tonight Show, walking out as a complete unknown and to kill them in 6 minutes, you need about 40 minutes of material that you're doing in a nightclub. That will distill down to 6. So then they want him to come back in 3 months, do another 6. So he takes another 6. So his first 6 is the best 6, right? Of course. And then the next 6 wasn't as good. And then he came back a third time, struggled, and he was gone. And that's when I went, oh, I see what's going on here. Now I see what this is. This is something that it's write or die.
On the day you write something, why will you not talk to somebody on that day about what you wrote?
Because you don't want to damage the accomplishment that you did your work that day. You will feel good that you did your work. And you always want to support that motivation. And if you think of something and you think, hey, I think this is good, and you tell someone, 99% they're not going to react the way you want.
And this is despite the fact that you yourself will heavily critique your work.
That's right. That doesn't do you much good. I don't judge the work. The audience does. They edit the work. I tell them, here are my 10 ideas.
Yeah.
They tell me, you got 2 good ones out of that. And you go, oh, okay.
But if you like some of the other ideas, that's when you'll continue working.
I will fight them sometimes. I had a bit about poker that they hated. And I got mad about it.
What do you mean you got mad about it?
It made me mad. I actually did it on television before it was ready. And it bombed. And I got so mad. And then I thought, first of all, why did you do that on television? It wasn't ready. And it bombed. And I don't know. These are the ways in which I indulge myself. I believe in indulging yourself. I like to indulge myself in certain self-resentments and frustrations and go, you know what? I really suck at that. I'm going to get great at that.
Did it eventually work?
It did. But it took 2 years. It's about how I think poker is a horrible thing. You know, the mood in this room is horrible. Why are we trying to get our friends' money? These are our friends. Why would we want their money? So, you know, it was kind of a subtle thing, but I wanted to express that. I wanted people to understand how I see this. Yes, your hand's better than my hand. We shuffled the cards. All the hands are different. Of course some are better than others. We mixed the cards up. What is the victory here? So, you know, that's my perspective on poker.
Why will you sometimes count the syllables?
Oh, it's the timing, music. You have to, you're attacking someone's brain it's very much a martial art where you want to get it into a vulnerable state, attack it, and destroy it. Comedy is a very aggressive art form. But, you know, I was just working on this bit about artificial intelligence, and calling it intelligence or smartness, you know, it's like songwriting. You know, words have a feel. They give you a feeling. They have a sound. They have an edge. You're always seeking that. You know, Bruce Lee used to talk about that 1-inch punch, right? It was just 1 inch for the, like that into the chest. You know, and comedy's like that. You're looking for that thing that just, it has to hit. It has to have punctuation and rhythm and flow. And comedy, when it's good, the audience just, they don't even know what's happening. You know, you start a set and you don't even know it, and you catch the right rhythm and it's over.
George Shapiro,
mm-hmm.
You've called it like a marriage before. Mm-hmm. Somebody close to you told me it was more like a fatherly figure.
It was.
With your dad passing young.
Yes.
How do you think George influenced you?
He and I shared the joy of show business life. We care about the show and we care about the dinner that we're going to after the show equally. What are we eating, George? What are we going to eat after this? And we both appreciated, there was no angst. George had no angst. I have no angst. Things don't always go well. But we just feel like we're in show business. We're in heaven. We're in heaven on earth. Most people in show business, you probably know by now, you've talked to a lot of them, they're not even that happy. And they're in the greatest possible life you can have.
Most
a lot of them are miserable. Aren't.
Yeah.
To me, that's a sin. That's a sin. Because it's such a beautiful opportunity that you have.
But you and George like could not have been more different. Describe kind of the ways in which he was this like cheerleader of
He's very
energy.
Emotive,
yeah.
Very warm and welcoming, amazing with people. I am always around people who are fantastic with people, because I am not.
You don't think you are?
No, I don't. I try, but it's an effort. And I'm all my friends and my wife are amazing with people. So I kind of like to be with them and they kind of can interface and
why
engage.
Why do you think that is with you? You just don't care
I'm not
about
interested.
That? Yeah.
I'm not, if someone wants to chat casually.
You hate small talk.
My brain is like, I have to really think, what do you say now? What, boy, it's chilly for late March, isn't it? Yeah, what do you say? What do you say? It's true. It is chilly for late March. What do you say about that? I don't know. I don't know. But if you want to talk about, you know, can you believe they added 2 months to that the calendar used to be 10 months, and then they added the two Roman emperors. Okay, now we're talking about something. Now I can talk. But I can't talk to you about how chilly it is today. It's unusually chilly for late March.
On the sitcom front, you turned down 24 guaranteed episodes from a cable network in favor of 4 from NBC. Why?
Cable, well, it wasn't cable, it was Fox. Fox was an upstart network that seemed a little not great. And I wanted to be in the majors. I wanted to be in NBC. I want to play Major League Baseball. So I was willing to hold out for Major League Baseball. I don't want to be in the, you know, the South American League or whatever it is.
Was it a no-brainer at the time?
For me, yeah. Yeah.
From what I understand on the Larry front, he basically quit after getting kind of the first set of notes from the network.
He quit every season. Every season he quit. And I just would go, okay. And then as we got closer to when we had to start up again, he would come back.
Well, especially early on, how did you so quickly get to a place where there wasn't the network involvement?
BMW. BMW was buying tons of spots on our show because we attracted a wealthy, educated, intelligent audience. And NBC, after many meetings and many thoughts, went, hey, that's good business. We could make some money off of this. Now anybody would know that. But back then, you know, ALF was the biggest show on TV when I came on. We wanted to do what we wanted to do. And if you like it, fine. If you don't like it, fine. I always figured it would be a very obscure, I thought it would be like Spy Magazine. Just a small, weird thing for a very particular audience. But the actors changed. Michael, Jason, and Julia changed that entire paradigm. They changed that equation to something else.
Did the sitcom need to be as time-intensive as it was for you, you think, in order for it to be that good?
Yeah. Once we got it to a certain level, we weren't going to let it drop. That would have been devastating for us. We killed ourselves, physically killed ourselves. I mean, it was, we were totally physically exhausted for 8 months of the year, totally. You know, Larry and I together would sometimes write a 60-page script in 2 days.
Correct me if I'm wrong, you and Larry David would sometimes get into big, perhaps even screaming arguments.
Never over, had over a screaming argument.
He has said he would sometimes scream at you over a single word.
No, we never screamed.
Okay.
We would debate.
Okay.
To exhaustion, for the fun of it.
But like over a word.
Oh yeah.
Whether it's your stand-up or when to end the sitcom, timing was always incredibly important to you. What's the lengths to which you'll go in your mind thinking about that?
I just love good timing. I don't know why people today are so disrespectful, in my view, of audiences' feeling of timing. You watch movies that are clearly 20 minutes long, and you go, didn't you watch this with an audience and see how it felt? Can't you feel that? You can, you know, when I'm on stage, you know, my stopwatch is always running, and the length of that show to me is I have to hit it within a few minutes. And 5 minutes over is no good. You take an hour and 10 minutes of work, and you add 5 minutes to the end of it, and they're like, enough, just shut up already. And they walk out like this instead of, wow, that felt great.
Tell about the little mule inside of you named Artemis.
Oh, my friend Mario calls me. He said, there's a mule inside of me that he named Artemis. It's just a mule that just keeps working. Artemis pulls the cart. So I do like to pull the cart. I want to pull the cart. I don't want to hang out. In fact, I'm kind of off now for a couple of weeks, and I really feel a little not right.
Okay, so it's funny you say that, because I pulled a quote that you once gave that said, I get thrown off easily. If I have 1 weekend off from stand-up and I do something weird, I completely forget who I am and what I do for a living.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you go back on stage and... well, after the COVID, I hadn't worked for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And I had done a stand-up special right before COVID. So my whole act was gone. So I had to start a new act. And I hadn't been on stage in 2 years. And I would go to clubs and I would watch people on stage and go, how are they doing it? Where do they get the guts to go up on stage like that? I literally, it seemed like I had to start from... total scratch.
But how, when you've been doing it for as long as you have?
So let's say you didn't do any exercise for 2 years, and then you went into a gym. It would just seem daunting, right?
It takes a minute to get back in the routine, but then once...
Yeah, but two years.
Right.
2 years of nothing, just sitting. Imagine what it would be like to go into a gym. But... The stand-up stage is even more intimidating than a gym. It's a very intimidating place.
And speaking of exercise, how about how Body for Life impacted you?
Well, that was an exercise program I found in a bookstore in Milwaukee in 2004. And it was, that interval training was new and it was a very painful type of training, but very short. So that interested me because I didn't want to spend a lot of time exercising, and the intense pain seemed interesting too.
What do you mean seemed interesting?
I like to be in a difficult environment. I don't know why.
Well, because pressure on the system is generally a good thing.
I've just felt instinctively I'm going to do better under pressure.
And so you have a trainer, I think Adam Wright.
Yeah.
You'll do 3 days of cardio, 3 days of weights, as
I understand. I do something
it.
Every day.
So what is like the typical routine?
Exercise is so unfunny. I can't talk about it.
Wait, what do you mean
it's
you can't
so
talk?
Because unfunny.
But you have spoken about.
But it's not
how,
funny.
Yeah, but it's not
funny.
You have said it is exercise that kind of makes
well,
you.
Well, I just think the body and the mind are one thing. So if you exercise your body, then you exercise your mind. And the mind, I only do things that are good for the brain function. I care about brain function for the obvious reasons. I feel like I need the brain.
You once said, I've always had the skill of extracting the essence of any subject.
Yes.
I study, be it Scientology, Judaism, Zen, yoga, meditation.
Right.
On the
Marcus Aurelius is my new one.
How so?
The Roman emperor who wrote a book called Meditations.
Okay.
Which was the beginning of Stoicism. And that's my obsession now is Marcus Aurelius. He had this fantastic philosophical observations on life.
And you've learned what from that?
That everything that you're worried about is going to be gone like that. The people that are criticizing you, they're going to be gone, you're going to be gone. All this hand-wringing worry and concern over how are people viewing me, someone said something bad about me and you get so upset about it, is wasted time and energy. Marcus Aurelius says your only focus should be on getting better at what you're doing. Focus on what you're doing, get better at what you're doing. Everything else is a complete waste of time. So I have this movie coming out in about a month. I am so excited to read the worst reviews.
What do you mean?
Because they're so meaningless. That's what he thinks.
Did it take you a minute to get to the place of enjoying that, or have you always kind of been unaffected by?
No, it took many, many years.
Okay. On the transcendental meditation front,
I believe
you do it at least twice daily.
At least twice, sometimes more.
You said it's the greatest thing as a life tool, as a work tool, and just making things make sense.
Right. Do you
How
do
so?
Meditation?
I don't. I've tried it. I've tried it once, but.
Oh, great. Good try. What do you want in life, Graham? What do you want? What do you want to have more than anything?
I'd like to make the most of my ability and be happy.
And what does it take to do that? Energy. You need energy. It's the most valuable quantity of human life. Well, where do we get it?
And you're saying you get it from meditation.
Well, you sleep, right? That's about it. That's all you do to rest your body. The next time you get out of bed, before you leave the bed, stand up, turn around, and look at that bed. Does it look like what happened there was relaxing? Does it look peaceful, what you went through there? No. It's a necessary component of human life, but it's not the level of rest that you need and is available to you effortlessly. Meditation is effortless. Exercise is the opposite of that. Exercise is great for energy, but it takes more effort than anything. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do. Meditation is like if I said to you, I'm going to need you to get in a hot tub once a day and just sit there for 5 minutes. Could you do that? That's pretty easy. Pretty easy. Meditation is even easier than that. So if that's all you have to do to double the amount of energy that you have to accomplish what you want to accomplish in your Bensinger life, how do you not use that? So I'm speaking to you, trying to approach you as a very pragmatic person, because you seem very pragmatic. You don't do stupid things. You try and do things that make sense, right?
I try to. Yeah.
Okay. So that's what this is. You know the bar in your phone? instead of that was the yellow and the red, all white. Just boom, full battery. Full battery.
How have you felt that's extended your career?
Oh my God. Well, I'm 70, okay?
Which is shocking.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
So,
but that's not just because of meditation.
Yes, it is. If you ask me my three keys to a successful life, you want my three keys? Transcendental meditation, lift weights, espresso.
You said everything you do is about how to get out of today's depression.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen every day.
What's the feeling that you try and get out of?
Depression is probably too strong a word. It's just we all have these mood dips, you know, where you're feeling good and something not great happens, or you're late, or you see a scratch on your car and you just get depressed about it. And you can get depressed when things are going great. That's the most depressing.
When does it happen most for you?
Irrespective of circumstance, I just don't feel good. Sometimes just don't feel good. And the best way to get out of it for me is work. Work is the best antidote. That's why I work so much. Because it's for some reason, it just, you feel like you're not wasting time.
A tendency to be depressed is part of the kit that comes with the creative aspect
That's
of the
right.
brain.
That's right.
How did reading that impact you?
I realized this tendency to get depressed, I would never want to not have that if I would lose the creative gift that came with it. It's part of it. It's probably an overactive brain.
Right after your sitcom wrapped.
Yeah.
For a few months, you didn't do much. I think you're playing pool every
pool
afternoon.
I played pool for like a year.
In like a billiards hall on the Upper West Side.
Yes, yes.
You said, I was kind of lost after the show. I really didn't want to get married. I didn't want to be single anymore. I didn't know what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
What was that period like for you?
That's a pretty interesting period, you know. You kind of feel like you got to the end of the rainbow there, and so now what? You know, what do I do in life now? And
depressed then?
No, that's always the same. But and I don't know if I think most human lives are like this, you know. Good days, part of the day is good, part of the day you don't feel good. Sometimes you don't feel good a whole day. Some days you feel great all day.
Well, and I know I'm certainly like that, but then there are people that, you know, struggle with it more than others.
Yeah, too, I wouldn't call it real depression.
Yeah.
I don't know what the word for it is. I just call it the mood darkens. I get a darkening mood, and I want to get out of it.
How did having children impact your life?
You don't have kids.
I don't.
Someone that doesn't have kids would ask that question.
Okay, well, here was the connective.
How did it impact your life?
Here was the
How did having a human body impact your life?
So here was the connective quote had you
What did it feel like to be just a spirit sparking through the galaxy, and then you took the form of humanity? How did that change you?
Wait, so had you, the connective quote was, you had once said, if it wasn't for my kids, I'm pretty much done with living. I could kill myself. Now now there's something else to live for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the kids are the greatest show on earth. So you just want to watch them live. And the entertainment value of watching them try to live is, you know, I don't watch all the shows that everybody watches. I don't find them interesting.
What do you watch?
I watch baseball. And I like to see what the kids are doing. The kids are very entertaining because they're, you know, they're primitive humans. And it's fun to watch. You know, like you can't not watch the turtles try to get to the waves. You know, the little blue turtles when they run down the beach?
Yeah.
And some of them make it and some of them don't. Whenever that, you have to watch it. And so that's what kids are. You're just watching these turtles run for their life.
How do you think your upbringing impacted you as a dad?
Well, unfortunately, you think the way you were brought up was the greatest. And so you attempt to replicate it, or even worse, you attempt to improve on it. That's where you go really wrong as a parent. You think, my childhood was good. I'm going to make my kids' childhood perfect. That's when you really screw them up. Because perfect is not a good place to be for optimizing, you know, the human instrument. Imperfect is where you want your kids to be. I always talk about this bracket of struggle. If you stay, you want to stay in the bracket. Not too much, not too little, and try and move the bracket up as high as you can. So the worst thing with kids is when you try and give them pleasure or problem solve or praise. Those are my three poison P's of being a parent. Solving their problems, giving them pleasure. Don't give them that cracker. He likes this cracker. This is his favorite cracker. Give him that cracker. This is horrible.
It seems like you're increasingly interested in sharing, like, how the sausage is made.
Well, all parents do that. That you want us to, let me show you how life works.
But, I mean, it's not limited to just use a parent. I mean, even in just hearing you talk about things professionally.
I want to take the watch apart. My whole life is I want to take the watch apart. I like knowing the time, but how does this watch work?
Yeah.
That's why I can't chit-chat. Chit-chat is the time.
Right.
Let's talk about these gears. How the hell does this thing keep track of the time with a spring?
Marriage.
Yes.
Your wife said slow build in Jerry becoming a teammate.
Yes.
Explain that.
Well, I was 45. I was a very successful comedian. A comedian is an in-one act. You think, I don't need anyone. That's what a comedian thinks. This is not a good partner for it. Someone that doesn't think they need anyone is not a good partner. Partners want to cooperate with other people. This is why most comedians either fail at marriage or don't even try it. Jim Gaffigan said to me, every time he hears a comedian getting married, he goes, why? Why would he do that? It's really not for us. I wanted to do it. Again, because I wanted to see if I could do something I'm really not cut out for.
How was your idea of a good first date, her attending the taping of your HBO special
That's what I was doing. I mean, no, whatever your... I would bring girls to shows. That's you know, who's not going to do that?
Why do you think the relationship works?
You know, we're both extremely cranky and understanding of each other's crankiness and appreciative of crankiness. I don't like people that aren't cranky. I find them kind of boring. I like people that are really on the verge of exploding at all times.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, and she's great at that.
Oh, come on.
Come on, what? You're not married.
I'm engaged.
Oh, you're engaged. Congratulations.
Thank you. Should be married as of September.
Oh, good for you. I'm happy.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, this show's going to get you married. Some woman's going to see this and go, I think I'll hitch my ride to that.
See, I guess kind of serious friend. You guys decided to visit Israel mm-hmm. the end of the year. Mm-hmm. Why'd you guys decide to make the trip?
We're Jewish. And we feel very close to the struggle of being Jewish in the world. People think of Jewish people, I think, sometimes as very on top of things and unsuccessful for the most part. That is somewhat true. But the struggle of being Jewish is also ancient, thousands of years of struggle. And Israel is the latest one. And anti-Semitism is... seems to be rekindling in some areas. And so we just felt we wanted to do that to be supportive to the Israelis.
What stood out most to you from the visit?
That my life of what I thought was just being fun, having a fun life and making other people happy, which I love to do, had this other effect on these other people for a completely different reason. They appreciated me coming because I'm a well-known person and a comedian they like, but this was a whole different set of circumstances and emotions. We had we were having lunch one day in Tel Aviv, and there was a missile attack from Gaza. 26 missiles were fired at the city, and they were all taken out by the Iron Dome. It's tech that they have. And everybody has to run out of the streets and you have to get into a shelter because the metal falls from the sky.
How does that kind of shape your view on what's going on?
Well, I grew up in the 50s and 60s and World War II was kind of Vietnam, and I was never in the military. And you always wonder, what's a war like? You know, we've all read about it our whole lives, all wars throughout human history. What's it really like?
Yeah.
So I know what it's like now.
Unfrosted. I've obviously rough transition. I watched it over the weekend, and I mean, the cast is extraordinary.
Oh, thank you.
Also, the writing is so distinctly different than what you'd see in a typical film. What were the biggest pain points of the process for you of just the entirety of this project?
Walking onto a film set and being responsible for the camera angles, the actors' performances, my own performance. How many takes do we do before we move on? We're running out of time, we're running out of money. It's much different than TV. Doing the TV show was like going into your backyard, you know, and playing. Because we eventually, that world was our world. We just knew every inch of it.
Right. I mean, not immediately, though.
Not immediately, but after a while.
Right.
But on a movie set, you know, you're going to locations you've never been. You're going to be there for 2 hours. You got to get this. It was fun. It was crazy. It's just crazy. But the people that I had around me, people like Melissa McCarthy and Jim Gaffigan and Amy Schumer, and it's so funny.
On and on and on. How do you get that cast together?
I don't know. I just asked them.
But I mean, that's how, right? I mean, because
yeah,
you don't,
that's how.
Like, it's you making a lot of...
Except for Hugh Grant. He called me.
He called you and said...
Yeah, he said, I would like to be Tony the Tiger.
And you said...
You're Tony the Tiger. He said, do I have to do an American accent? No, I go do whatever you want. I just wanted to meet him. I love the guy.
What about him playing Tony the Tiger really resonated with you? Because I know you said his character was pretty cool.
Our idea of Tony the Tiger was he was a failed Shakespearean actor who had to take this humiliating job because he couldn't make his car payments. But he really wanted to do Shakespeare, but he's forced to do Tony the Tiger. That's our idea of Tony the Tiger.
How was directing harder than you expected?
Oh, not with the amazing people that I had. They were wonderful. They were incredible. I mean, Hugh Grant is a total pain in the ass, which he told me he would be. We had so many fun fights.
Okay, like what?
I would say to him, you're English. You don't know anything about comedy. You know about wit. English people are witty. I go, there's no money in witty. We do comedy. We get big laughs in this country. And he would scream, I know a lot about comedy. He was the best. He is my favorite.
There was an on-set blow-up that you kind of had to defuse, right?
I think so, yeah. There were a few.
Explain the kind of most notable situation.
My favorite one was, there's different teams on a movie, different departments. There was a prop guy who was a little tightly wired. And, you know, they arrange things, you know, like whoever started this fire and they put this stupid stuff here, you know. And some guy on the movie, he just lost it and started screaming at one of his assistants. And I went, everyone stop. I mean, screaming like crazy loud. I go, everyone stop. This is a Pop-Tart movie. None of this matters. We will not have any screaming. This is not important. I made a big deal out of the fact that this is not important. We're here to just make a silly movie.
You turn 70, April 29th.
Yeah.
I think you're doing press for the film that day.
Yeah.
I believe it premieres shortly thereafter.
Yeah.
But so it's not as if you have much time to celebrate the birthday. But how do you view turning 70?
I'm not really that interested in me. Or my age, or I'm just on this ride like everybody else. Just like, okay, where's, you know, it's like Disneyland. You're just on this little cart going along the track, and you're going, all right, so we're going to make a turn now. I wonder what's going to be around the turn. So I don't care.
I've heard you talk a lot about like what still motivates you mm-hmm. and the arc in the creative process. How would you assess where your talent is today relative to whatever you think its peak can be?
Peak can be. Mm-hmm. I still have to get to the peak. I'm not there. Wow, that's exhausting. You know, I let the audience tell me how I'm doing. And they keep coming, and they clap, and they laugh. So that's it. We're all going through this ride together. To me, me and whoever the people are that like what I do, I want to make this ride better for them. You know, that's what I live for. I want to put a smile on as many faces as I can. And that's a pretty good life if you get to be someone doing that. So I don't care where it's going or where I'm at. I'll be on stage tonight. And if they laugh, I know, okay, we're still doing something right. And that's what I care about.
Thanks for doing this.
Thanks, Graham.
That does it for my chat with Jerry Seinfeld. I had mentioned before how long it took to book Jerry. Originally, it was email correspondence with Jerry directly, which started as him saying no. After a couple years, no's turned into at some point, and then later, as we neared the release of his Netflix film Unfrosted, it became let's make it happen with his team. So super grateful for the opportunity to have done this. Jerry does not do a lot of long form interviews and have a lot of pride and a lot of gratitude for his willingness to give us the opportunity. To see video clips from our time together, go to youtube.com/GrahamBensinger. Remember to give this a rating and review. Thanks again for listening.